There is one reason that corn and glass products have been in American kitchens for more than 160 years. They're guaranteed not to break.
Until Corning invented Corel livingware, no dishes that were so much like china could take everyday pounding.
The New York manufacturer sold off some of its better-known lines, like Pyrex, in the 1990s, and started making most of its remaining products overseas. But Emma Jacobs reports it is one company that's doing well by reinventing itself while still making some of the toughest glass in the world.
The shift change whistle still sounds four times a day in Corning, New York. Though these days, the whistle mostly reminds Corning Incorporated's office workers and researchers that it's time for lunch, since almost all manufacturing is done elsewhere. Jim Flaw is the company's CFO, works out of the firm's Soaring Glass headquarters. He still has a lot of the old Corning cookware in his basement from his days in housewares. But he says even Corningware was a product of the company's longtime investments in research in Corning.
We spent money on R&D, and the people at the top of the company would talk about it almost as if it was a religion.
So hit the drop button.
Don Clark works in a lab that runs performance tests on the company's latest rising star, super thin, tough Gorilla Glass. Clark has a particular demonstration he likes to show off. He's rigged up a device to shoot a Wii, that's the game remote, into a pane of Gorilla Glass. The Wii hits at around 60 miles an hour.
Hopefully this doesn't break, but here it goes.
Oh, yeah.
And it bounces right off. Demonstrations like this one seem to have convinced manufacturers of everything from cell phones to televisions. Gorilla Glass was on some 200 million phones last year. And though managers at Corning coyly say they can't confirm what Apple uses in its products, it's widely reported that much of that Gorilla Glass went to iPhones. This year, Gorilla Glass sales could reach $1 billion. That's almost a sixth of Corning's total sales last year.
My iPhone was actually run over, and although the back of the case was really kind of pitted from being run over, the glass itself did not break.
Not every iPhone owner is so lucky, but Jim Kelleher of Argus Research says there's no doubt Corning's glass lines are strong. Corning has had bubbles burst before, but this time he says the company has not just Gorilla Glass, but other products too that come out of solid research that meets companies' needs. And while a lot of glass production happens overseas, 40% of Corning's employees are still in the U.S., The company's CFO, Jim Flaws, who got his start in dishes, says there are no plans to move the R&D operation from home. He says the benefits of having Corning's technical resources concentrated here outweigh any costs. Even in a downturn, he says,
we didn't cut back on the research and development because we view that as really our future.
Corning makes ceramic filters in upstate New York, and the company's expanding its onshore operation in Harrodsburg, Kentucky, to make more Gorilla Glass. Corning has also begun testing in Kentucky on what it hopes will be its next big advance. Glass so thin and so flexible, it will be rolled up and sold on spools. For NPR News, I'm Emma Jacobs.
Microsoft scored a huge hit with its Kinect game controller. Yesterday, the company said it has sold 10 million since November. That makes it the fastest-selling electronic device in history. NPR's Zoe Chase reports.
Ernest Crumline came into the store to buy a Wii. He saw the Kinect demonstration set up and said he had to try it. The game works like this. You have to mirror the moves of the guy on the screen, and the Kinect reads what your body is doing. If you get the moves right to the Soulja Boy Tell'em dance, in this case, you get points. The runaway success of the Kinect means you're going to see a lot more devices like this coming from Microsoft.
Microsoft is working hard to have you interact with lots of screens throughout the day. So a screen in your nursery that monitors what's happening with your baby.
Amy Webb consults with top tech companies, and she says that sophisticated sensor technology in your own home is going to be the new normal because consumers are loving it and they're willing to pay.
So that's $233.17.
The sticker price of the Kinect is $150. But Crumline had to buy the dance game, too.
And I bought insurance for it because more than likely it's going to fall because I'm going to buggy.
That works for Microsoft. Zoe Chase, NPR News.
And now, Flora Lichtman is here with the video pick of the week. What do we have this week?
Hi, Joe. This week we have a video put together by our producer, Catherine Wells. And it's about another kind of robot, one that doesn't sing and dance, but it does make some people's dreams come true, I think.
Okay. And all right. So I'm intrigued. What's going on?
It is the Espresso Book Machine. It runs about $100,000. And Catherine visited the McNally Jackson bookstore in New York and talked with one of the book buyers there, John Turner, about this machine and why they have it. It prints books, basically.
So why do you need a robot to print a book? There's printing presses to print books.
Well, this is a good question. First of all, the robot will print books that are in the public domain but out of print. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that opens up some new opportunities. And I think the major kind of excitement about this is that if you have your Great American Novel on your desktop, you could go to this bookstore and print it out as long as you put it as a PDF file and design your own cover.
You know, we just were talking about robots as performers on stage, now robots as... I think my concept of a robot is being shattered because I still think of, you know, Robbie from Lost in Space with its arms filling. I guess robots mean a lot of different things now.
This is really kind of like a souped-up Xerox machine. But it does make some neat noises.
I'm sure his mother is not going to be happy about that.
And you can see it.
Souped-up Xerox. Well, okay. You
can
see
it. On our website.
Go see it on
our
website.
See for yourself.
There you go. Don't take our word for it. All right. Thanks, Flora.
Thanks, Joe.
And that's it for today's program. Our program's senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Bergquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Intagliata, Catherine Wells, and Alessio Bayak. Neil Rausch is our technical director, and at the controls here in New York is Manoli Weatherall. If you missed a part of this program or others, go to iTunes and subscribe to our podcast, audio and video. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com and take SciFry along with you on your iPhone and Android apps and continue a week-long discussion on Twitter at SciFry. Join us on Facebook, too, if you'd like to write to us. Please send your letters to Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, Room 306, New York, New York, 10036. Or you can email us. The address is scifry@sciencefriday.com. And do check out Todd Machover's opera and work. It's pretty remarkable stuff. In New York, I'm Joe Palca.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. When it comes to the business of bringing movies and TV shows into your home, Netflix is king, but the competition is heating up fast. The latest initiative comes from Facebook and Warner Brothers, as NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
The Facebook-Warner Brothers deal is tiny. At this point, just a single movie, The Dark Knight, available on Facebook for 30 Facebook credits or $3. The move comes on the heels of Amazon.com's announcement last month that it would give its so-called Prime customers the ability to stream about 5,000 movies, documentaries, and TV shows for free. Netflix says it isn't surprised by the competition.
You know, it's pretty unusual for the world to let you run away with a couple $1 billion in revenue and a large market cap without testing the waters.
Ted Sarandos is the chief content officer at Netflix.
Now, I would say, do we take some comfort from the running room we have? Absolutely. We have a huge library of content, and we have a great relationship with over 20 million subscribers.
The company's rise has been quite stunning. It went from 12 million to 20 million subscribers last year, and it's now streaming most of its content rather than sending out DVDs. Kevin Warbeck, an expert in internet technologies at the Wharton School, suggests we're witnessing part of a decades-long shift in our viewing habits. We've gone from a world with only network television and theatrical releases of films to an explosion of online content.
It's gone from a relatively simple marketplace where there were a few kinds of content and fairly clear rules about how the content got to different places to anything goes, and no one is quite sure how things are going to come out in the future.
Right now, Netflix has the clear advantage in number of customers, size of its library, and its streaming technology. But lots of companies are trying to chip away at its lead or change the video distribution game completely. Movie studios, cable and phone companies, Apple, Google, and Amazon are just some of the players.
You click on and bingo, and I can give you a great demo here real quick.
Cameron Janes heads up Amazon's Instant Video.
This is an example of one of the great titles we have. This is Amadeus.
Mozart!
Amadeus won the Oscar for Best Picture in 1984, and much of the content Amazon Prime customers can stream for free is old. But Amazon, known as a fierce competitor, says it's just getting started. Dan Rayburn, an analyst at Frost & Sullivan, a research and consulting firm, likes Amazon's strategy. The company can draw more customers to its premium service and use the extra revenue to buy more and newer content. And Rayburn says he could easily imagine Amazon making its Kindle video compatible.
Well, that means Amazon controls the device, the platform, and the distribution. That's something Netflix can't do.
But remember, there are lots of players in this market, and it's quite possible the market will simply fragment, with lots of companies distributing content in lots of different ways. It's hard to predict the future, but Netflix executive Ted Sarandos says consumers have reason to be happy.
Competition is always good for consumers and generally good for the players involved. This is a marathon. It's a long race. We're just entering into a very important phase in online video delivery.
And it's not yet clear just who will be at the finish line. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. In Austin today, new tech trends are taking root, tweets are flying, and everybody's interacting. It's day four of the South by Southwest Interactive, the influential technology festival, and Omar Gayaga is there as he covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman and tweets away with all your, would it be your tweeples?
My tweets, yes.
Welcome back to the program.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
So this is a city full of early adapters, and I'm wondering what are the tastiest morsels that the tech companies and the tech gurus are serving up?
Well, there isn't really a breakout technology or app like there was in 2007 with Twitter or last year with the location apps like Gowalla or Foursquare. But one thing people are talking about is group chatting apps, apps like Beluga or GroupMe or Yobongo. There's several of them. And what these allow you to do is create smaller private groups of people to talk with, either from your contact list, from Facebook, or there's some apps that let you talk to complete strangers based on where you are. So that's one thing that's emerging, but there's so many of them that it's been really hard to pick one that's really standing out. Beluga seems to be the one that I've seen people use the most, but there's not really a home run yet that we've seen at the festival.
So I'm in San Francisco. I'm a saxophone player. I make homemade sausage, and I like the Red Sox, and I want to find someone who's just like me, and I can use one of these chats to find them.
You're the most interesting person I've ever met. but it's more based on location, like finding strangers who are around you who might want to chat, or finding specific people in your own contact list or Facebook groups that you only want to chat with in a private room, as opposed to tweeting everything publicly on Twitter or sending emails through Facebook and other applications.
And the festival itself is newsworthy in that it's getting so big.
Right, it is. It's been about 30 to 40% growth last year, and then another 30 to 40% growth this year is what we're anticipating. So it's really been about the lines and can people get into these panels. It's been a bit of a logistical problem, and it's something the festival is really going to have to take a hard look at for next year. They're talking about perhaps capping attendance for next year, which would be a big change.
If you spend any time on the web, on Facebook, on Twitter right now, there's a lot of news, information, chatter about what's going on in Japan. And I'm wondering if the terrible news out of Japan is somehow influence the festival in some way, and what's going on that score?
Absolutely. The festival started on Friday, so as early as Thursday night, people were already tweeting, you know, what can we do at South by Southwest? And by Friday morning, a website had already popped up at SXSW4Japan to raise money, and it's already raised $23,251. A lot of the panels have shifted their focus from whatever they were going to be talking about to Japan, and there's a nonprofit called Dog Bless You that promised to donate $100,000 if 100,000 people like their Facebook page, and they're already at 121,000. So yeah, that's a big hashtag Twitter conversation at the festival is how can we help Japan? How can we raise money? Some people have pledged not to buy an iPad 2 and donate the money instead to Japan. So it's definitely been a major topic of conversation this year at the festival.
That's Omar Gayaga. He covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman. He joined us to talk about the latest from South by Southwest Interactive. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Amazon is fighting on another front, the tax front. Last week, Illinois joined a handful of states that have passed laws requiring Amazon to collect state sales taxes. Amazon calls the legislation unconstitutional. If you've wondered why books or other products on Amazon tend to be cheaper than at your local store, one reason is the absence of state sales tax. In other words, Amazon has had a competitive advantage. To explain all this, we're joined now by Janet Novak, executive editor at Forbes, who has been writing about this issue. Welcome.
Thank you.
To the program. Tell us why Amazon has not had to charge sales tax in most states.
Well, back in 1992, in a decision called Quill, the Supreme Court ruled that a state could only require its sales tax to be collected if a retailer had a physical connection. They call it a nexus to that state. And Amazon hasn't had a physical connection to most states.
And since 1992, has Amazon craftily avoided having a nexus in lots of states?
Absolutely, absolutely. It has built its strategy around the advantage of not collecting sales taxes.
States now are saying that they're losing lots of potential revenue at a time when they're stretched. And what's Amazon's line on that?
Amazon's line is, okay, get Congress to pass a national law that requires collection by everyone, and of course, we'll comply. But in the interim, we're not going to disadvantage ourselves by collecting.
You mean like a national excise tax on internet sales?
Well, or more a national law that says states can require their taxes to be collected if they simplify it.
How much money do you think is at stake here? Have you been able to quantify how much a state could bring in by way of sales tax on Amazon purchases?
Well, Illinois, which just passed the law, thinks it's losing $170 million a year. Overall, the figures run up to about $20 billion a year. It's real money.
Now, as you said, Janet Novak, the system that presently exists is based on a 1992 court decision. I can't even think back to the internet in 1992. It's an infant in those days. Al Gore is talking about it and trying to wake up the country to it in 1992. Could that ruling anticipate the situation we're now in?
It couldn't anticipate it, but it had a similarity. It was based on catalog sales. So they said, well, if all you do is you take the orders over the phone, you mail in, you ship by FedEx or UPS your goods, then that's not enough of a connection between a merchant and a state for the state to say, hey, collect our tax.
If indeed the number of states that adopt a sales tax, say, grows to a dozen or so, do you imagine Amazon reconfiguring its operation to avoid those states and to move to other places?
Well, what it faces a problem on two fronts. One is this law that says if you pay marketing fees to other websites that are in our state, we want you to collect our sales tax. Now, New York passed the first such law, and Amazon is collecting sales tax for New York, but it's also challenging that law in court. Meanwhile, any other state that follows, it has pulled all its marketing agreements from those states. So that's one front.
Mm-hmm.
There's another front, which I think is actually more significant. Amazon is a $32 billion a year organization, and it is locating warehouse fulfillment centers all around the country. Well, it's hard to say there isn't something physical mm-hmm. about a warehouse.
Mm-hmm.
So Amazon has asked the states to agree that if it puts a warehouse with warehouse jobs in their states, they won't require it to collect sales tax.
Janet Novak, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Janet Novak is executive editor for Forbes, and we've been talking about the question of taxing sales by Amazon.
This is NPR.